This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Rethink 2014.
The American economy.
Climate change without.
Hacking.
Different religions in it.
Sustainability.
Social media.
Security. Freedom.
Technology.
Marriage.
Essentially ethics.
Privacy.
Throughout the month, we've had conversations that provoke new thinking about social mobility, America's role as a global superpower, and the role of fantasy in marital fidelity. Today, an inquiry into the medium that we are sharing at this moment, radio. Since the dawn of the digital age, we've been hearing that the end of radio is nigh. With countless online streaming services and podcasts available on mobile devices and now cars, listeners can create their own playlists and preferences, and radio will go the way of the buggy whip and the printed newspaper. While program directors and sales and development teams have been fretting over how to keep audiences, people like Jesse Thorne have been creating them. Jesse is host and producer of NPR's program Bullseye. He's also the founder of Maximum Fun, a podcasting network that is home to several popular comedy podcasts, including Jordan Jesse Go and Judge John Hodgman, both of which Jesse produces and co-hosts, and the storytelling series Risk. If that's not enough, he also hosts Put This On, a video series and blog about men's style. Jesse, so glad you could make time for us today. Welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Okay, Jesse, so does the future of public radio mean that I have to have as many jobs as you have?
Oh, man, you're starting with a real pain point. I mean, I never expected to have this many jobs. I just thought I would get a regular job. When I graduated from college, you know, like I went to a pretty good public university, you know, sort of mid-level public university, and did well and had a nice college radio show and thought I could just get a job at a radio station and do that as my career. And it just didn't work out that way. And it's not working out that way for a lot more people in media these days. And there's sort of a good side and a bad side to that.
You're straddling this world pretty successfully. You have a terrestrial radio show. That means carried on radio stations, you know, that have radio towers. And you also have podcasts, which are available online. I guess a question to start with is, do we need to rethink what radio actually is now that we have mobile devices and connected cars and audio streaming? Am I still listening to radio?
Radio as it is, as it has always been, has some really great advantages. One of them is ubiquity. You know, the average American household has something like, I can't remember, it's like 9 or 11 radios in it. So basically every room in your house has a radio in it somewhere, whether it's an old Walkman or a clock radio or a shower radio or a car radio in your garage. So there are very few places where you can't just press a button and there's the radio. It's coming out of a speaker and you can enjoy it. You know, radio is also locally based and typically locally based and live. And so, you know, it can be responsive in ways that media that doesn't have those qualities can't be. You know, I live here in Los Angeles. And I grew up in San Francisco. If I want to know if I just felt an earthquake, it's actually more convenient for me still in 2014 to go to the radio than it is to go to the internet usually. So there are some advantages to radio, and they extend to the places where we tend to listen to audio the most, like cars. You know, cars all have radios in them, and almost no cars have the ability to stream data.
But that may be true now, right? I mean, a couple of observations here. People under 25 do not own radios or listen to radio as we program it here at NHPR, for example. And cars will have onboard computers soon enough. Right?
Yeah. Well, I would say that young people still do consume a lot of radio. You know, it's less than it was before, but they still do consume a lot of radio. You know, radio isn't any more going to disappear than books are. You know what I mean? It has some built-in conveniences and, you know, it will be a long decline and other media will replace some elements of it, but it's not going to totally disappear. As far as why public radio doesn't, well, it just doesn't program for those people. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have the incentives to program for those people because it's, you know, substantially donor supported and young people don't have the money to make major gifts that sustain public radio stations or institutions. So while the mandate is there to serve all people, the incentives aren't.
Okay, well, there are two different tracks here. One is the survival of the future of public radio, which means that public radio darn well better get young people listening because they want them to listen through their life and support. But let's go down the other track here first. We've been hearing about the predictions of the last days of radio for about 20 years now. So I was surprised to read Pew's State of the News Media 2013. That study showed that 92% of Americans age 12 or older listen to the radio at least weekly. Why then all the doom and gloom about the death of radio being nigh?
Well, I think the truth is that there are other options on the horizon. And it's easy to think that this is a dichotomy, which goes, number one, this is 1973 and FM radio is on the rise and everybody's jamming out to the latest hit from the Doobie Brothers. And we all have a mass culture that's propagated by, you know, Wolfman Jack or whatever. I'm mixing up my time periods a little bit here. I hope you'll forgive me.
We're still with you. You're in the album rock era right now.
Yeah, somehow. Exactly. So it's the peak of radio when you listen to your local morning radio DJ to go line up for concert tickets for 8 hours, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, the people think it's that golden age or it's radio is dead, blah, 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 blah. Radio has some great advantages that I think will keep it alive for a long time as things decline slowly. One of them is it's relatively inexpensive to produce radio compared to, say, a newspaper, which requires a team of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. Radio is relatively inexpensive to make. That was one of the reasons I could make a show totally by myself for 6 or 7 years, however long it was that I was doing my show without help. Audio is within one's grasp.
We're speaking with Jesse Thorne, a sort of radio impresario of sorts, both in the terrestrial and the online or podcast universe of radio, about the future of radio, where we're rethinking that paradigm, the way that it's always been, that radio has come from some station somewhere and been listened to by the masses. Well, now it's being produced by people and selected by people individually. And that's a question for you, Jesse. You know, right now, everything hinges on self-selection, right? Especially if you're talking about this under 25 cohort. These are people who find things that they want to listen to, podcast them, stream them. How do they find things? How does your podcast, for example, get distinguished from all of those that are out there?
Yeah, I think that's one of the big challenges in the world of the internet. I think what we've seen the last 5 years or so, as social media has become sort of the dominant form of the internet, it's sort of replaced the, you know, the blog role on a personal website in that way, is that quote-unquote viral content becomes dominant, which is to say content that someone wants to tell someone else about. That is not always the best content. Being the best content can help, but generally it is something that inspires emotion, that has a surprise in it. Those are the things that go viral, and that's what's dominant right now. That's a lot harder in the audio space, but you still see its effects. I mean, I think that if you take the example of my friend Mark Maron's show, WTF, which is a very big podcast, you know, hundreds of thousands of listeners, I think Mark's personal story and some of the incidents that happened on his show early on. Mark is a stand-up comic who had sort of hit a brick wall in his career and then decided to do this podcast. And the show is about him sort of working out his issues as he talks to his colleagues and contemporaries and so on. And that story was viral in and of itself. You know, it's something you want to tell someone else about. And that is sort of what spreads these things. It doesn't work as well as it does with, you know, with text or in some cases with short videos. But, I mean, the other things would be if someone is famous, if something is well-known from outside of the world of internet audio, you know, if it's the Oprah show or whatever, you know, Adam Carolla had a huge fan base before he started podcasting, and he brought them into podcasting with him.
Well, we're just scratching the surface, so please stay with us as word of mouth continues our rethink of radio. In a world without dials, when we just choose what we want to hear, will radio still be able to surprise us in the future? Will public radio continue to exist? We're going to ask those questions and much more after the break. Stay with us. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth from NHPR. Today's Rethink 2014 takes aim at a medium that we are all sharing right now, radio. Like so many people listening at this moment, I grew up thinking radio was the thing on the kitchen counter, which brought us the morning news. Later, I listened to Top 40 and broadcasts from the faraway city of Boston, in rec rooms and car radios, far away from our parents. This is where I still get the morning news and so much more on public radio. That is to say that I'm admitting a strong pro-radio bias and an investment in radio as a broadcast medium. Word of Mouth also welcomes and celebrates the many creative ways that people are turning traditional broadcast on its ear. My guest, Jesse Thorne, is one of those people. He's host of Bullseye on NPR and founder of the phenomenally successful podcast network called Maximum Fun. He's here to rethink this medium that you, me, and every supporter of public radio is a part of. So, Jesse, I've just admitted my pretty traditional experience with radio, which was self-selecting to a degree. But I'm remembering also clearly the first time that I heard a public radio story that made me think, wow, I never would have thought about that before. It was in the backseat of my father's car. There was a story about Jews in rural Mississippi. And I just remember, you know, hearing about the experience of Bubba Kornfeld. I'm not kidding. That was really his name. And I thought, I never would know about this guy. Something connected to me. Now, will people who are curating their own experiences so carefully based on what they like to hear, will they be surprised? Will they just be kind of confirming their own biases as we hear about what we do in the news and searching out news?
Well, I think that one of the things that people like the most is to be surprised. So, you know, if you're talking about ideology or sort of cultural cohort, yeah, I mean, I think that will continue to be focused, but I think that's already focused now. I mean, I think the audience that listens to public radio is demographically and culturally significantly different from the audience that listens to Hot Talk. But I think that in terms of moments and feelings, you know, as I said, one of the biggest categories of viral videos is something where something remarkably surprising happens. Mm-hmm. That's what people tend to tell someone about. You know, this conversation where we're talking about ideas and in a slightly abstracted manner isn't the kind of thing that goes viral on the internet. If I told you a personal story about how my grandmother died, but I learned an important lesson that helped me bring my child into the world, and it related to this, that is the kind of thing that would go viral on the internet. And to some extent, that's the kind of thing that you're talking about.
All right. So let's get to your grandmother then. Well, I want to go back to the numbers thing here, or the ubiquity, I think, is what you're talking about. You said Mark Maron's podcast, really popular, hundreds of thousands. Okay. For years, Morning Edition and Rush Limbaugh have been switching places as the most listened to radio broadcasts on terrestrial radio. It was only in 2012 that Rush had his first significant dip in ratings, went down to 14.75 million weekly listeners from 15 million. Other big numbers here. Howard Stern used to serve about 20 million listeners on terrestrial radio. Then he went to satellite radio, now maybe 1.25 million listen at any given point. So the numbers, very, very different measures of success from somebody doing a podcast, hundreds of thousands, compared to tens of millions of people who are listening to terrestrial radio. Now, I don't want to sound like, you know, a newspaper editor in 1999 or defensive in saying that our numbers are so much better. I want to ask you where you see that heading.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that that will continue to be the case. I mean, the truth is that there are things that lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of people like. They're like the Super Bowl, you know, or American Idol. There are things that are designed for huge audiences. And there are things that are so great that they get huge audiences, you know. But there are things that will always be like that, like the Super Bowl. Those things are immensely valuable. I don't think they're disappearing forever. But in the world of the internet, you have something very different, which is the difference between something that is good enough that someone won't change the channel and something that's so good that someone chooses it. People will go to extraordinary lengths to just continue on whatever path they're on. So picking something is a really significant act. You know, that's why advertisers always want to advertise to 18 to 34-year-olds, it's because once you've decided that you like Crest toothpaste, you know, you just use Crest toothpaste forever just because it would be a hassle to pick a new toothpaste because what if it wasn't good, you know?
Right.
And so people don't like picking things. So if it's something that someone has picked, it's a much deeper, more powerful relationship. I know that of the tens of thousands of people that listen to one of MaximumFun.org's shows on a podcast, that audience is so much more connected to the programs than the tens of thousands of people who listen to Bullseye on the radio. Mm-hmm. And that's in the context of public radio, where I think listeners are relatively strongly connected to the content they're listening to compared to, you know, 105.4 Hits FM.
Right. Such good programming that people choose it. And in public radio, we count on them to then pay for it directly, which brings us to the financial model, which I think we have to talk about if we're rethinking radio. Right now, I'm looking at the top 10 podcasts on iTunes, very heavy with public radio programs. This American Life, Radio Lab, along with, you know, Dan Patrick and Welcome to Night Vale. People are definitely appreciating and downloading interesting stuff. But for the terrestrial radio station, this is where things get dodgy for us, that your podcast, Roman Mars 99% Invisible, Radio Lab, can invite people to support them directly. The downside is that it is taking money, perhaps, from hardworking radio stations like New Hampshire Public Radio. So is that going to cause tension between those who are program makers and program carriers?
Well, I mean, I think it does cause tension, although I don't necessarily agree 100% with the – I mean, I think the premise that you're asserting causes tension. I don't know if that premise is really 100% correct. I think that people's giving – is about what they care about. It's not about what they've given to other things. You know, we live in a very profligate country. You know, people, the United States is very rich. The people who give to things have enough money to give more. Even if you make $35,000 a year and you give $50 to your local public radio station, you still have another $50 to give to something else if you are moved to do so. So I don't think that it's a zero-sum game. I don't think that giving to one thing means that you're not giving to something else. You know, the science of nonprofit development, my dad was a fundraiser for most of my life, backs that up. So I would say that people have really significant relationships with their local public radio stations. I mean, I care very much about KPCC and KCRW here in Los Angeles. I grew up in San Francisco, and I still care very much about KALW in San Francisco. And that relationship is one that people want to support. And local public radio stations provide a service that's different from what a podcast does. A podcast is a really cool thing, but it isn't an always-on source of stuff about where you live, and it's not a curated collection of stuff that's designed for people who live where you live, and it's not a brand that you have known and trusted for decades, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
But what if you're raised getting free content everywhere? You know, there's no if you're used to that model, what is going to make you shell out for anything, connected or not?
Well, if you want to see it, if you want to see it continue to exist. I mean, when I told my dad that I was going to start this thing, my company, as a mostly donor-supported for-profit company, he thought that was the craziest thing in the world. And now I'm sitting in an office with 8 or 9 employees and, you know, really significant revenues, because I think that while there is this feeling everything should be free, I also think that there is a feeling that goes along with that that is underrepresented, which is this feeling of, and I should support things that I like, which is the way of paying for everything should be free. I mean, you in the radio business and me both in the radio business and in the podcasting business are giving everything we do away for free. Anybody in New Hampshire with a radio can listen to New Hampshire Public Radio for free. So the people who are supporting us are the people who think that is a significant thing and want to see it continue. But I generally think that that feeling that young people get everything for free because they're so entitled is wrong. And in fact, young people want to get everything for free. They want to have access to everything. They want that promise of the internet that they can get the things that they love the most, you know, without there being an impediment to them doing so. But they also want to support those things so that they can continue to exist. They want to have a relationship with those things. That can include, you know, giving money voluntarily.
Jesse Thorne, is it sunny there in Los Angeles?
It is pretty sunny. I think the high is going to be in the mid-70s today.
Do you think we could all come and work for you?
Yeah, absolutely. By all means. I'm putting up a shingle. I'm hiring the entire state of New Hampshire.
Jesse Thorne, host and producer of NPR's program Bullseye, among other things, also the founder of the podcasting network Maximum Fun. Thank you so much for your time today.
Of course. Thank you so much for thinking of me.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. In some musical circles, there is an unspoken commandment when it comes to live concerts. The louder, the better.
You're on 10 on your guitar. Where can you go from there? Where?
I don't know.
Nowhere, exactly. What we do is if we need that extra push over the cliff, you know what we do?
Put it up to 11.
11, exactly.
Unfortunately for Nigel Tufnell of Spinal Tap, turning your amp up to 11 does not, by definition, make music sound much better, clearer, or even more rock and roll. In fact, a lifetime of overly loud music can leave fans and musicians forced to listen to something nobody wants to hear.
One of the most common forms of tinnitus is called ringing tinnitus, and it is just a tone, something like this.
About 50 million Americans suffer from tinnitus, or ringing in the ears. Among them, Neil Young, Eric Clapton, Metallica's drummer Lars Ulrich, and Will.i.am of the Black Eyed Peas. Despite the risks, many musicians and fans do not protect themselves by wearing earplugs or turning down the volume in their earbuds and headsets. Molly Boschman is a concert photographer and a contributor to Pitchfork, where she wrote about tinnitus and the cultural bias against wearing earplugs. Molly, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
How loud is too loud for our ears to handle?
There's sort of a threshold of 85 decibels that most audiologists agree is a threshold after which long-term exposure, which means anything more than a half hour as a general rule, is dangerous. What happens is tinnitus is actually a neurological problem that originates in the brain, and it involves the miscommunication between noise-damaged sensory cells in our brain. So when our ears get jostled by very, very loud volumes of noise, like an explosion or noise coming from a rock concert, there's a failure of those noise transmitters to properly communicate impulses to the auditory nerve in the brain, which is a long, convoluted way of saying you shake it too much, it'll never stop ringing. And small venues where sound is trapped and sort of recirculated and reverberating against these hard materials like the concrete of a warehouse or the concrete of a basement where you might be attending a small show, will trap and reverberate sound such that even if it is played at 85 decibels, which the average rock concert is not, it's more like 110 decibels, the volume can sort of get ratcheted up with sort of an echo effect.
Well, that puts people, musicians and people who work in the live music industry, as well as, you know, I'm guessing people who operate jackhammers or something, at the highest risk of ear damage. But as you point out, people in the audience don't always protect themselves, and musicians don't always either. Is there a stigma against wearing earplugs in some professional music circles?
I definitely think, depending on the genre, you see this more. For example, a lot of punk music and metal music, as well as the historic loud rock and roll, any sort of genre of music that has a certain visceral nature where the experience is supposed to be very cathartic because it's, you know, so loud and uninhibited and explosive. Those genres, I do think there is a sort of unspoken stigma about wearing earplugs. You know, it's sort of like the equivalent of you know, plugging your nose over a chef's food would be to wear earplugs in a concert setting where by nature you may be expected to experience some sort of not quite direct like physical pain, but a sort of shock. You know, in those cases, I definitely think there is a conscious decision not to wear earplugs, even if you might end up with some ringing in your ears, because maybe people associate it with a job well done on the part of the musician.
And I guess there's also this sort of, you know, there's the devil may care attitude, or I don't want to grow old anyway, so who cares if my ears are ringing? Well, there are lots of debates also as to whether the earplug actually diminishes the concert experience. Objectively speaking, would you rather go see a band play at a safe volume, or would you rather wear earplugs and have them play really loud?
I would love for musicians and for venues to play music at safe levels to begin with. But since for a confluence of factors, that's not necessarily possible today, there hasn't been a big dialogue about why music is played this loud. And I think there's a miscommunication between the audience and people who work in the venues and musicians who aren't necessarily always aware of how loud they are because speakers are facing away from them. That kind of leads to this. There's not really a public dialogue going on about this issue. And as a result, I don't think many venues are going to be playing music at safe volumes anytime soon. And as a result, I would definitely encourage anyone who loves music and experiences it in the live setting to consider wearing earplugs, which most audiologists agree. You won't lose a significant amount of sound or anything vital to the mix by wearing earplugs. You can only protect yourself.
All right, we've talked a lot about live shows, Molly. How about wearing earbuds? Is there a maximum level that we should be turning up our earbuds to?
It's interesting. When you read the information on the earbuds that come with, say, an iPod, the literature actually suggests that, you know, listening to concentrated streams of music at very high volumes can be dangerous. But conveniently, they don't quite tell us how loud that is. Is that with the volume all the way up at 11, for example, like in the Spinal Tap clip that we heard? Or is that anything above the midway point? I would say, you know, there's never such thing as too much music as long as you're listening to it at a safe level. So, you know, if you're going to blast your iPod for that moment on the subway just to cancel out a short-lived conversation that you don't want to hear, that's probably okay. But if you're walking around 24 hours plugged in, playing and listening to music at a maximum volume, perhaps you should reconsider your daily activities.
All right, Molly Boschman, who, as we heard, only occasionally turns it up to 11. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Molly Boschman is a concert photographer and a contributor to Pitchfork. You can find a link to read her article, How Loud is Too Loud? It's at wordofmouthradio.org.
She took me to the south with a rolling in her mouth, a cabin made of wood.
We're listening to the song The Night Replaced the Day by the band Spirit Family Reunion.
She was just no good. Oh, she was just no good.
The five-piece band hails from Brooklyn and has come a long way since their days busking at farmers markets. Spirit Family Reunion spent 2013 touring the country in a van in support of their debut album, No Separation. The album got lots of critical praise and attention and propelled the band to the stage of the Newport Folk Festival and to record a tiny desk concert at NPR's headquarters. Now Spirit Family Reunion is kicking off 2014 with an East Coast tour and will be playing at the Press Room in Portsmouth on Friday, January 31st. Producer Zach Nugent spoke with lead singer and guitarist Nick Pankin and asked him how a band from the big city came about playing such old-time American music.
Growing up in New York City, you know, we sort of get exposed to and listen to all different kinds of music, but there's definitely a healthy dose of, you know, Pete Seeger growing up, Woody Guthrie music, and if you go to summer camp in New York State, I don't think you can escape Pete Seeger. So it's kind of like when you get that into your ears when you're a little kid, and then when you go, you know, later on in life, when you hear the banjo again, it feels so familiar, and it feels like something from your childhood. And it doesn't require too much thought or planning. It's just kind of like, you know, it's just kind of from the bone.
Baltimore. I don't need carpet on my floor. Grab your coat and follow me. I know a man in Galilee. Green, rocky road. Promenade green. Tell me who you love. Tell me who you love. Tell me who you love. Tell me who do you love.
Circle, circle, circle down. We're listening to one of your more popular songs here, Green Rocky Road. And it's a tune that's been around for a while. Can you tell me about it?
Well, when we started playing Green Rocky Road, we just kind of were listening to this record by Karen Dalton of the same name. It has a bunch of songs that are just home recordings of her playing banjo. And she's just got a really cool sort of unique style.
When I go to Baltimore, need no carpet on my floor. Get your coat and follow me. I know man in Galilee.
So we learned a bunch of songs off of that record, and that's where Green Rocky Road originally came from to us, and then it just sort of morphed into this thing that it's become.
One of my favorite tracks on the album is No Separation. What can you tell me about that song, and why did you choose it as the name of your album?
No Separation is a super duper simple song. It's three simple verses and one extremely simple chorus. It just feels like an honest song, and it could be played any style, like the Carter Family, or it could be played, you know, super fast, like an old-time sort of song, or, you know, the way we played it is just kind of heavy and slow.
I don't want no separation. I don't keep no bad company. I don't need no
It's a fun song to sing, and I guess it's, you know, it's part of about being all together, our band, you know, it's a bunch of folks playing music together, and, you know, we want to get to know each other, and we want to get to know the audience, and we don't want the separation between the crowd and the stage, we don't want, you know, I mean, I'm so glad I have these people to play music with still after, you know, five or whatever years.
And that was Nick Pankin, singer and guitarist of Spirit Family Reunion, speaking with Word of Mouth's Zach Nugent. Spirit Family Reunion is going to be playing at the Press Room on Portsmouth on Friday, the 31st. For more information on the show and to hear more from the band, you can go to wordofmouthradio.org. All right, stick around for another powerful application of sound. We're going to hear about a groundbreaking approach to surgery that does not require a scalpel. High-intensity focused ultrasound. That's when Word of Mouth continues after the break. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. When you think of the future of advanced robot-guided surgeries, you might think of lasers, right? Think again. A relatively new medical technology called high-intensity focused ultrasound uses acoustic waves far above the limits of the human ear to essentially disintegrate tumors in the prostate. and incredibly in the brain. It's been used for several years now in the UK, although not yet in the United States. Dr. Caroline Moore is surgeon at the University College London Hospital. She works with high-intensity focused ultrasound, or HIFU. How does this technology differ than, say, the ultrasound that we are used to seeing to check on developing pregnancies or to diagnose heart problems?
This ultrasound is focused into a very accurate beam, which means that you can treat a very small part of an organ that you want to treat.
How about you as a surgeon? What are you doing when using HIFU to treat prostate cancer? Is the operation more or less automated? Are you focusing in on one place? What's happening? And operating the beam?
So first of all, it's a question of getting the position of the HIFU probe exactly right in relation to both the prostate and the area that you want to treat, and the rectum, which you don't want to treat. So first of all, it's a question of positioning the probe correctly, and then planning your treatment on the ultrasound screen by marking out very precisely the areas that you want to treat. And I base that decision on MRI scans and biopsies that have been done prior to the operation. And then during the procedure, it's a question of monitoring the screen carefully to check for heating of the rectum when you might need to take a break in the treatment, and also to check that changes are happening in the prostate in the areas that you want them. And sometimes you need to do some adjustments, putting water in around the probe or removing water from around the probe to get the distances just right to make sure that the focus of the beam is exactly where we want it to be.
What can HIFU do that you cannot accomplish through conventional means? And why, for example, does it make prostate cancer such a good candidate for this kind of surgery?
Well, it's really good for treating a small area of the prostate. So in traditional surgical terms, it would be very difficult to take out, say, half of the prostate and be left with good function in the rest of the prostate. But an ablative technology like HIFU can treat half of the prostate and then scar forms in that area, and the other half of the prostate can remain as it was effectively.
Sometimes we do hear about these revolutionary medical technologies, but the cost of producing them is so staggering that it's questionable whether it would be practical. Any sense of the cost of these HIFU machines and whether the cost can be recouped?
Yes, I think they make quite good sense compared to other ways of treating the prostate. So in the UK, a typical machine might be around £100,000, and that cost, depending on how it's sort of shared out, would be recouped in probably 2 to 3 years. It's about a fifth the price of a robotic surgery.
And do they only use this at your hospital, or are other hospitals across the world or in the UK using it?
Yeah, so there are quite a lot of other hospitals across the UK and in Europe using it. It's not licensed in America at the moment.
What's the appeal for the patient in this case? The cost being less, it being less invasive? How would you paint out the advantage for someone who is receiving this kind of operation?
So the advantage is in the short stay in hospital. So almost all of our patients are done on a day surgery basis. They have the procedure and go home the same day. Preservation of sexual function is high. The majority of men will be able to get erections afterwards, with about 1 in 3 men needing tablets. And that's a lot better than the traditional surgical outcomes for that. And the risk of urine leakage is low. So it's about 1% if you have about half the prostate treated.
New Scientist recently wrote about HIFU being used for brain surgery. Where else in medicine do you think there are advantages for high-intensity focused ultrasound to become an asset or a standard practice?
So I think the kidney is an organ that could quite usefully be treated with HIFU. People have looked at that in different ways. So the barrier to ultrasound waves around the kidney are the ribs, but it is possible to use the space between the ribs to treat. So it's suitable really for solid organs. That's one of the most useful places for it.
Caroline Moore, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Caroline Moore, urologist and surgeon at the University College London Hospital, one of the hospitals in the UK using high-intensity focused ultrasound, or HIFU, to treat prostate cancer. There's a link to much more on her and to New Scientist article on HIFU. That's all at wordofmouthradio.org. High-intensity focused ultrasound may operate above the limits of the human ear, but that doesn't mean the operating room is a quiet place. Not unlike carpenters or artists or mechanics and other tradespeople, many surgeons prefer to whistle while they work, or in some cases, bang their heads. Word of Mouth's Taylor Quimby spoke to a couple of New Hampshire doctors to find out what is on their surgical playlist.
So I'll make this quick because I'm sure you're busy.
Okay.
Can you tell me your name and what you do?
Hi, I'm Dr. Quimby, and I'm a urologic surgeon at the Cheshire Medical Center in Keene, New Hampshire.
And you're my dad.
And I'm your dad.
Right. When you go into the operating room, do you have a choice of music? Like, how do you listen to music, or do you even get to listen to music?
So most of the time we do listen to music. We have essentially a kind of an iPod docking station.
What do you like to listen to? Say, you know, everything's going well, you're grooving along, you're jamming, you're doing your thing.
I would listen to some U2. You know, one of the things that I really remember was back in residency when I was a surgical intern, we used to play U2 during our closing, you know, Street with No Name, because it was just has that, you know, upbeat music to just get you to finish up and sew up a patient's abdomen. I want to reach out and touch the flame
where the streets have no name. I happen to know that you listen to the Dark Knight soundtrack by
Absolutely.
Hans Zimmer a lot. Do you ever put that in the operating room?
Yes, I have put that in there. I've listened to that in the operating room. It's really actually great classical music.
My name is Paul Bettinger, and my specialty is hand surgery. I don't know if you remember the station K-Rock.
Mm-hmm.
So they've nicknamed me the Doc of Rock. I like to play heavy metal in the OR. I've been listening to heavy metal since I was a teenager, and I've been kind of playing heavy metal in the operating room ever since I've been in the operating room. And so now what I do is I kind of tailor the music to the level of anesthesia for the patient. So if they have general anesthesia, then the heavy stuff comes on.
Right.
And if they have kind of a regional anesthesia where they're kind of awake, then I put the lighter rock on.
What are your favorite bands or things to play?
Yeah, so for the heavy metal stuff, I like to play Korn and Metallica, Godsmack, Five Finger Death Punch. Today I played Avenged Sevenfold.
That's like really hard stuff.
Yeah, oh yeah, it's heavy stuff. We're going for the hard stuff.
How do your nurses or, you know, the people that work with you, does everybody...
Yeah, they're all on board with it. They've gotten used to it over the years, and I've converted some people over to the dark side. Have you ever been hated or discriminated against? I have. I've been protested. There were times where I'd play some rap, and, you know, if I was playing like Eminem and he's really starting to go off,
yeah.
People would get a little upset. But most of the heavy metal stuff, they can't even understand the words, so they don't really, you know, they don't have the opportunity to be bothered by the words. They don't really understand it. You know?
It must be great for you compared to, say, being a dentist, where you're pretty much obligated to play really bad music.
Right, exactly.
While people are in the chair.
Yeah, that's why I didn't go into dentistry. I couldn't take the music.
The Doc of Rock, Paul Bettinger there, an orthopedic surgeon at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Hospital in Keene, speaking with producer Taylor Quimby. We're grateful that you could spend some time with us. Today, Word of Mouth's Rethink 2014 series explored the future of radio. Are the days of turning the dial over? Or has the rise of digital given birth to an audio renaissance? Tell us what you're listening to these days, which radio shows and podcasts most excite you. The conversation is already hopping. It's on our Facebook page. Here are just a few of the programs already mentioned. Freakonomics Radio, The Moth, Selected Shorts, and Radiolab. So have we missed anything? Is there a podcast we just have to hear? After all, the best suggestions travel via word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.